This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Welcome to another edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio, with your host, Dave Mitchell. Today we are visiting again with Mary Solwants, a Kansas City environmental activist who we initially spoke with on March 31st. Due to some technical difficulties, our interview was shortened, and we decided to have Mary back for further discussion on her news on our planetary peril. In addition to being an environmental activist, Mary is a writer, poet, artist, and speaker. She taught English for 10 years, has been a stay-at-home mom, a program director for GreenWorks of Kansas City, a farm-to-school coordinator for De La Salle High School, founded her online blog Tonic Wild in 2011, and One Less Pipeline in 2016. Mary has some very insightful observations on our difficulties in responding adequately to the existential perils inherent in human-induced global warming and the mass extinction of species. Mary, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay. Just a note to our viewers, if we do get cut off, if Mary and I do get cut off, we'll call Mary on a smartphone here and reconnect. So just have patience. Mary, in our prior conversation, you recommended, you strongly recommended the book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who is a botanist, writer, professor of plant ecology, and a Potawatomi woman. An online library summary indicates her central argument is that an awakening of a wider ecological consciousness requires the acknowledgement and celebration of our reciprocal relationship with the world. And as a Potawatomi woman, she learned to consider plants and animals to be our oldest teachers. What are a few themes from Braiding Sweetgrass that have most influenced your thinking?
So I came to this book, I think, this year. So I just started reading it, I think, in the wintertime. And there's just so many things to love about it. I think one of the things that is most striking about how she braids her indigenous knowledge and wisdom with her scientific wisdom is just this incredible intimacy and reverence. And it's very rooted, her experiences and what she's describing is very rooted in place. So there's this, there's nothing abstract or disconnected from what she's talking about when she talks about her relationship with the living world. I also just, the idea that plants and animals are elders to be respected, again, to me that implies that we have sort of a humility about us, ourselves, our place within ecosystems and in relationship to other living beings. And so that idea, again, to me kind of goes with that sense of place. Not only will we know our place, but that idea of where we are in the hierarchy of beings metaphorically, but we also know it in a very visceral way, in a very contextual, concrete way. And so those are a couple of things that really struck me. There's this also, this, within that paradigm is this idea of bounty, and that the living world is based on abundance versus the capitalist mindset, which is all about scarcity, right? So there's something beautiful about this idea of bounty, and again, that's rooted to place. Wherever you are in the natural world, there is enough. It is our job to figure out how to live and align ourselves and our needs with that bounty and not try to lord ourselves over it, if that makes sense. So those are some of the themes that really resonated with me.
Yeah, those things definitely resonate very strongly with me too. I think the the whole idea, I don't particularly like the word sustainability, but the whole idea of coming into our harmonious relationship with the natural world is to find a way to interact with it and in a way that's beneficial. And and that's a whole lot easier said than done, given how many people we have and the kind of society we have. Is there anything, I think, Robin Wall Kimmerer, she's a PhD botanist, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And she's a scientist, and she comes from, I really like that idea of having a reciprocal relationship with a sense that there's a connection between us and the natural world, us and plants and animals.
Right, and what I like about that reciprocity, according to how she's defining it, is that we are not the masters here. We are being guided by the natural world in terms of how we reciprocate and what our right and appropriate role is in that reciprocal relationship, rather than we are determining that. So when I think about that as a gardener, I'm thinking about how I've been conditioned to designate some things as edible and some things as weeds, rather than understanding that what's growing here and in my garden is of value, not only the thing that I planted. And so the old thinking was that if I'm weeding, I'm creating space for the things, my agenda, for the things that I want to grow. And, of course, as someone who grows food, that's kind of the way we do things, rather than there's so much out there that's already growing that heretofore has been and is edible and medicinal and also serves, in some cases, a spiritual function. Like, it's all already there, but we have created a dualism that says some of it is worthwhile and some of it is not, and it's a false dualism. We can't have that dualism and have an abundant, a mindset of abundance, if that makes sense.
Right. So does she argue in Brady Sweetgrass that the earth is a living being? Does she make that argument or that assertion? Does she talk in that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what are your feelings on that? I mean, how do you envision that?
If the earth is a living being,
yeah. Can you say something about that beyond that statement?
I mean, maybe, as opposed to what? Like, what's
well,
the other?
Yeah, of course it is.
And that just flies in the face of so much of my conditioning as someone who grew up in a Judeo-Christian setting where the earth is something that we act on. And that's one of the things that I really, really enjoyed about her book, and that was eye-opening, is that Native American languages, so many of them, they are majority verbs, where the English language is majority nouns with fewer verbs. That means most things are considered it, right? Something to be acted upon rather than they have sovereignty and are animate from within. So that's a whole different mindset in terms of approaching the world around us, because language creates the paradigm with which we engage everything else.
Right.
So of course it's a living being, but we have conditioned ourselves to forget that.
Yeah, I know. Not only the Gaia theory, put forth by James Lovelock in his book, I think The Revenge of Gaia, or it's one of his books. He posits that the idea, and the Gaia theory basically is that the Earth acts as a living being, and he comes from an extremely scientific background, and he kind of came to the same conclusion. But in terms of language, I mean, I know that one of the things that you talk about, one of the central ideas that you talk about in your writings is the failure of the environmentalists of the global north not engaging the consumerist expectations pressuring the average American family, many of whom are black and brown. You see the need to identify and pull back the veils of consumerese, that's the word you use, and engage mm-hmm. in a wide education in the ideas and language of environmentalese. And how would you define those ideas?
Well, before I explain how I define it, let me talk a little bit about the background behind that. So okay. I learned a lot about environmentalese from researching environmental issues and from my work with GreenWorks, and I learned a lot from working with Bridging the Gap. So I taught myself a lot, and I learned a lot through the environmental nonprofits that I worked with and volunteered with. So that was happening along one thread. And then the other thread was I became a mom and had children. And when they're very young, it's quite possible to raise them up in an environmental world, like, you know, buying things only from thrift stores, limiting the access to the consumer pressure that's on families. And then they go to school, and then all of a sudden you are thrown into a world where you are expected to engage in this level of consumerism that is antithetical to a habitable planet, just point blank. It just, right. You cannot consume the amount of stuff that they ask you to consume when you have children. And then kids will get into activities, and then all those activities require gear, require uniforms, require you to sell more unsustainable stuff, and then to go on trips and so on and so forth. So there's this trajectory of consumption, and then there's birthday parties. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's bewildering. And so I felt like I was on two tracks that never intersected. And when they intersected, it was in this very nominal sort of even performative way, like, oh, look, we're going to use reusable plates at a kid's birthday party. Like, that's minor compared to what is ultimately necessary for all children to have a habitable planet.
Right.
So I felt like I was in it speaking one language, environmentalese, when I was in these environments, and then consumerese when I was engaged in my children's schooling and then their extracurricular activities. And so for me, it was like we are all going to fall in that vast crevice right there between these two things, because these languages are not speaking to each other. And what's interesting is, like, environmentalese has a particular set and formula of what is appropriate environmental behavior. You know, it's the three R's. It's the reusable everything. It's solar panels. It's EVs. It's native plants. It's, you know, all of that stuff. And then the consumeries, or what I feel like is the most dominant culture, is based on a whole bunch of behaviors, and particularly school culture is based on a whole bunch of behaviors that say, well, your goal is to get a job so you can buy a bunch of stuff, right? And so it's like we are conditioning kids to go on a particular trajectory. And sometimes those two cross paths in that, but both languages are completely external action driven rather than relationship driven, which I put in contrast as we're talking about, like, I want to bring in Braiding Sweetgrass for a minute. The language that she uses to talk about the planet is a language of relationship. Environmentalese is not a language of relationship. It's a language of, here are the things to do.
Oh, you mean consumerism?
Like,
yeah. Didn't you mean consumerism?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Didn't you mean,
like,
consumerism?
Okay.
It's not
an example, yeah. So
yeah, okay.
You're supposed to recycle. Don't use a plastic straw. Go buy a metal straw. Drive less. Change your light bulbs. Turn off lights. You know, buy used clothes. Like, it's all these behaviors that are context-free. At the same time, consumerese is saying buy this, buy this, buy this. You need this. You need this. You need that. That's also context-free because there's no ecological understanding of where that stuff is being extracted, manufactured. You know, we don't know anything about the story behind the thing that we are actually purchasing. So both of them absolutely disjointed from the living world and from the people in the living world. We don't talk about, like, environmentally, it's about me and my relationship with the planet, and overlooks, especially in the environmental movement of the global north, overlooks the people along the way who are impacted by our environmental choices and our consumer choices. Does that make sense? So it's, there's disconnect in both languages. Neither language is sufficient for engaging the world in a just and sustainable way.
Right.
Neither language is adequate because they're both siloed, and they both are pursuing their own agenda.
Well, they're both. It sounds like they're both siloed, and they both fail to truly address what we need to do. I think is the.
Absolutely.
That's my sense of it. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely correct. Yeah. I guess an example that I really harp on is the whole idea of metal straws. Like, we learned that plastic straws were bad because they were harming sea animals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative isn't to replace one thing that we know that is bad with something else without considering the impact of that something else, right? Like, what's the point of metal straws if we don't know where the metal was extracted, how it was manufactured, what was its environmental footprint to get to us from our, you know, here in the United States? Like, that doesn't make sense. But so that's what happens when we take a piece of one language and, you know, insert it into a way of being. We can't go on with this way. So
right.
I guess that begs the question, so what do we do? And to me, it's like, how do we re-educate or start to educate children from a very young age at school in ecological literacy? So it's a language that where we understand our choices on the living planet, on other human beings, on other living beings with whom we share the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So because, again, when we study science in school, it's very siloed. It's disconnected from the day-to-day impact we have on the planet. So kids learn about the water cycle, but that's disconnected from how they impact the water cycle by their choices.
I think the idea when you talk about consumers' expectations, I think about the fact that there's so much pressure just in terms of the way we live our lives, and that there are just certain accepted things about the way we live our lives, and one would be is that you can fly all over the world for vacation or to see your mom in Seattle this is an accepted way of living, and I think I personally, you know, there's what I'm struck with in the environmental movement is that there are many volunteers that I know that live high carbon lifestyles, and there's a disconnect, you know, there's a disconnect between their supposed commitment to working on whatever the issue is and the fact that they live, that there doesn't seem to be any commitment in their personal lives to living a lower carbon lifestyle. So,
yeah, that's tricky. Part of it is because it's not about relationships. It's still siloed. You know, we're not immersed in sort of a relationship with ourselves in a sense, and also with each other, and also the particular, I always think about this in terms of the particular longitude and latitude that we are in. Like, all work has to start there. Where do I live? What is here? What do I share this particular place? Who and what do I share this particular place with? What is this space supposed to look like in a natural way? I was thinking about lawns and how ubiquitous they are and how they're not a thing. They're not real. It's an illusion because they don't exist in the natural world and they're not habitat for anything. And yet they're everywhere, and that sort of disconnect from what is supposed to be here naturally, that is habitat and offers us abundance, has been removed. I mean, that's another form of disconnect that we don't talk about, you know, right, enough in my world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the whole drive of our consumerist culture is there's no question that we are we're engaged in a process of ecocide, essentially, and
yeah,
that through global warming and the mass extinction of species. So the entire collective human impact of the way we live our lives that's doing this. And I know you talk, a central idea you talk about is the fact that to really truly, my understanding is from your point of view, is that to truly move forward, we need to sit and dwell with our grief over the damage we're causing, you know, our planet. And I know, can you talk about that a little bit, and why it's necessary to do that?
Well, so I think for me, the grief is about what we're doing to ourselves, what we're doing to each other, what we're doing to other living beings, and what we're doing to the planet. And I guess in that order, like what we're doing is, how we live is incredibly violent, and yet it's a normalized form of violence. And that's very grievous. I mean, we are disrespecting ourselves and what we were created to be in this world. And I don't mean that like in a Judeo-Christian way. I just mean how I think COVID-19 is just showing how deeply traumatized we are, and how deeply traumatizing our world is in terms of how we are unable to, we are unable to take care of those most vulnerable, and we are absolutely callous with those most vulnerable. And who is being most impacted by COVID-19 is the most vulnerable. So that, mm-hmm, to me is sort of like a template, a very real time template of the sort of grief that is ever present in my mind when I'm thinking about environmental issues, particularly when I put that in contrast with consumerist lifestyles, that the things that we choose, and as parents, a lot of times we choose things out of love for our children without understanding that what we're doing out of love for our children endangers and threatens the lives of children elsewhere around the world. And that is grievous. And the wall of ignorance between us and understanding that, the impact we have on others, that is something to reckon with. And that is something that environmentalism doesn't get at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that language isn't there to talk about how we are impacting others by our consumerist choices.
Right.
And yeah, and so to me, that's what I call environmental supremacy, this idea that we can make all these choices here, even as environmentalists, that are completely removed from the lives and suffering of other people and other beings elsewhere.
Boy, this is a lot to unpack. I mean, I know we just have a few minutes left here. You know, I know that, you know, I know in your workshops that you offer to faith communities, you talk about emphasizing the seeking of healing, emancipation, and the affirmation of community through the spiritual lens of atonement. And you know, I know. Can you talk about the process of atonement a little bit? You know, how we how that dovetails in with our grief. In two minutes.
In 2 minutes. Yeah. You know, I think.
Maybe that's not fair of me to ask that.
No, that's fine. It's a good challenging question because it just helps me fine tune my own thinking, right? So thank you for that. I think one of the. Well, so I am on this journey myself. So, as all of us, my perception and my understanding is always evolving, right? So one of the things that when I worked for Greenworks and when I was first starting in the environmental trajectory, I was very pious, and I had a lot of environmental piety and a lot of judgment towards what is right environmental behavior and what is bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's this pretty strict line of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in terms of being an environmentalist. And so there was a lot of judgment there. And I think when you have a checklist and you follow that, it's easy to forget that it is about humans and their needs and their wants and their aspirations. And all of us are constantly juggling those things in the choices that we make and our woundedness, right? Like, we make choices out of our wants, our needs, and our woundedness, and our aspirations. And all of that we carry with us. So when we sit and talk about what is the right thing to do in terms of the environment, we have to take in all those things into consideration. And so what I want, if people come to my workshop, is to not walk away feeling guilty and overwhelmed and burdened,
right,
but to understand themselves within all those things, and then also, like, so that's one circle, and then the outer circle is, okay, how does that fit into my community, and then how do we draw those rings out into the world and other living beings, and then the living world?
Well, and I think in atonement is the process of being able to, forgiveness, you know, forgiveness of forgiveness of self and forgiveness of others for the way they're living. And Mary, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I really apologize. But,
oh, no, thanks for the conversation.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show, and we didn't have any technical glitches this time, which is always good.
That was fantastic. Yeah, okay. Thank you for the work you do.
Okay.
KKFI is definitely a necessary radio station during these times. Especially, but always. So thank you for the work you do.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
And thank you for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. Tune in next week when our host, Pat Riley, will have another intellectually stimulating discussion about the issues of the day. Now, we do have just enough time to say today is Tuesday, Giving Tuesday. This is a nationwide effort to encourage support for those in need. As we know, during this time, there are just really lots and lots of needs out there, and there's a lot of nonprofits that are doing a lot of good work to help those in need. There are arts organizations that are really hurting now, that if you can find a way to support them, we're asking you to give some consideration to that. But KKFI is also one of those nonprofit organizations. And if you would choose to support us during Giving Tuesday, we would appreciate that. If you want to, but we do want to encourage you to at least participate in Giving Tuesday. If you're one of those that was lucky enough to maybe get some stimulus money, but you didn't really need it, maybe you could use that to share with some of your community organizations. If you would like to support KKFI, which obviously we are one of those that also are having our own financial issues during this season. So if you do want to support KKFI, you can go to kkfi.org or giving us a call at 888-931-0901. Again, thank you for tuning in to Radioactive Magazine. And as always, keep your dials tuned right here for Counterspin, followed by Taste of Tejano, right here on KKFI 90.1 FM.
Today is Giving Tuesday Now, a nationwide effort to encourage support for those in need. KKFI is here to serve our community, and it is the reason we exist. We only continue to exist because of your support. On this Extra Giving Tuesday, we ask that you make the choice to give if you can. We know not everyone is in a place to do that right now. But if you are, then make a gift to someone who needs it today. If there is somewhere else that you feel like you should support, then please do that. Just take the time today to show your support for an organization that is helping or directly to someone you know. If KKFI is one of those organizations, then we certainly would appreciate your support. You can make your gift online at kkfi.org or by calling 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901 or kkfi.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, CDC data suggests that U.S. deaths from the coronavirus are far higher than reported, according to a recent New York Times story, upending the notion that the virus is only killing people who would have died from other causes anyway. The new data shows coronavirus has brought, quote, a pattern of deaths unlike anything seen in recent years, close quote. The problem is that data-driven story has to compete with others in the paper and elsewhere that suggest that we're moving quite smartly toward reopening the economy. And pushing to make that happen soon is an equally legitimate position to hold. Corporate media are constitutionally committed to leaving unchallenged the notion that our choice is between sending folks back to workplaces and public spaces that might be unsafe and letting them stay home and give up paychecks and health insurance. That worldview undercuts their ability to bring us the basic information we need. We'll get an update on pandemic coverage from Jim Narikas, editor of FAIR.org. Also on the show, author Gerald Posner told The Intercept last month, pharmaceutical companies view COVID-19 as a once-in-a-lifetime business opportunity. And it isn't a matter of a handful of outlier, especially greedy companies. This is the system. But as real as drug companies' imperative to take advantage of people being sick and scared so they can make a bigger profit is the growing recognition that this is unacceptable, pandemic or no pandemic. Peter May Barduke, director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines program, joins us to talk about that piece of the problem. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. There was a story in the April 29th New York Times about how even as coronavirus cases in the U.S. have surpassed 1 million and more people have died than in the Vietnam War, Donald Trump and Jared Kushner are pushing the line that the White House response is a great success story and we're on the other side of the medical aspect of this. It's the sort of elite media reporting that imagines it's holding Trump and his cronies up to derision with withering terms like revisionist history and at odds with the reality on the ground. Mr. Trump has demonstrated a striking tendency to try to frame the political narrative on his own terms, even when at variance with the facts, says The Times, as it provides a platform for him to do just that. There is some great data reporting, of course, but corporate media's overweening focus on competing narratives or spin colors and clouds their own relationship to the facts. Dangerous at all times, it's especially reckless in a time of still evolving public health crisis. Joining us again to talk about what we know about the reality on the ground of COVID-19 is Jim Narikas, editor of FAIR.org. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jim Narikas.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I say to talk about what we know about the pandemic, so much coverage seems to be reflected through a lens of what the speaker wants or assumes. Since the economy has to reopen soon, how do we do that? You almost have to force yourself to pull back and just look at actual information, who's getting sick, where, who is dying, and so on. But I know that you've been concerned that reporters aren't being tenacious enough on what you might think would be question one to stop a virus, you know, the news we could most use, namely, how are people catching it?
Yeah, I do think that is an incredibly important story that is not really being covered. The fight against the coronavirus involves certainly healthcare workers trying to cure the sick, but really the bigger terrain that this is being combated on is keeping people from getting infected. And we have to do that ourselves. No one is keeping us from being infected except our own actions. So we need to know what works to keep us safe and what is putting us at risk. And I don't think that media are really giving us the information that we need to know what those risks are.
Yeah, they're talking about sort of cultural battles between people wearing masks and people not wearing masks, but it's sort of apart from a conversation of do we have evidence that that works? Because, of course, if you know how people are catching it, you'll also know how people maybe are not likely to catch it, and we can shape our actions around that.
And it does seem like the kind of thing that reporters can do to talk to people who are sick, not all of whom are gravely ill, and ask them what they were doing, you know, what their lifestyle choices were under the lockdown. I have seen some good reporting on sort of case studies that have been done mostly before the lockdown that show that there can be, you know, a great number of cases spread from a single social event where people are in a room together and give the coronavirus to each other. But I have not seen that kind of reporting done to talk about where the new infections keep coming from now that most people are sheltering in place.
The way that media refer to something in what we call the boilerplate, the sort of thumbnail description they give of an event or a phenomenon, it really reflects, it might be inserted into lots of different stories, but it reflects kind of their essential message about this situation. And with that in mind, I know that you took issue with the way AP, very influential wire service, was kind of describing the coronavirus. What was the problem there, and has it changed?
They seem to be using the same boilerplate. There's this paragraph they stick into just about every article that they write about the coronavirus, and it seems to reflect a fear that people are too worried about the coronavirus. It stresses that this is mostly a problem for people who are old or have health problems, and concludes the vast majority of people recover. You know, the vast majority of people recover from cholera. You know, it doesn't mean it's not a deadly disease. I think that this is really sending a message, especially to young people, that this is not something that you need to take seriously. It's not something that is going to affect you. So why worry about it?
Yeah, and they talk about, well, it's just with people who have underlying health conditions. But then when you parse that out, that turns out to be a large, very large number of people.
Yeah, a huge number of people are considered overweight, have high blood pressure, and may not be aware of it. It works out to be about half the population have the kind of underlying health issues that they say are dangerous.
Well, in this Time story that I saw yesterday, Jared Kushner says, we're on the other side of the medical aspect of this, and I think that we've achieved all the different milestones that are needed. You know, he's a humanoid, and the piece is trying to make clear that these claims are out of step with reality, you know, but media themselves have talked about a peak, you know, and us being on the other side of some, you know, having turned some kind of corner, or other countries having done that. And they do it with what looks like data and charts and everything. What's troubling you there?
There is this, I think, very comforting idea that as quickly as the coronavirus arrived, it will go away. There are these charts that have been widely circulated from an outfit at the University of Washington that show very neat peaks where the infections go up and then they come right back down again. And when you look at the math behind these forecasts, you find that the assumptions that they use require that the disease go away as fast as it arrived. And in fact, when they correct their data for a steeper increase in infections, they have to correct on the other side and have the disease going away just as fast. When you look at the real world and you look at the course of infections in countries that have had the coronavirus for longer, you do not see a sharp peak with the infections coming down. The coronavirus outbreaks can linger for a long time with a long period of ongoing death at relatively the same rate. And that seems to be a more realistic view of what the end game is going to be here.
Well, everyone, of course, wants to see hopeful news, and there is hopeful news out there. We just want it to be based in reality, you know, and not in sort of magical thinking. But you took issue with a New York Times piece the other day out of Rhode Island. What was that about?
Well, the point of the article was that Rhode Island has done a lot of testing, and it was really trying to assert that Rhode Island only looks like it has a bad outbreak of coronavirus because they test so much, and so they're more aware of it. But really, when you look at deaths from coronavirus, which is not subject to bias from doing a lot of testing, they have like the seventh worst case in the nation. They really have been hard hit. And while they have, to their credit, ramped up testing, they did that like 2 weeks ago. Since they've been at this high level of testing, they continue to have new cases rising. And that's not because of their testing a lot. It's because they actually have an ongoing infection that is serious. And the article was framed as the fact that they're testing so much will make it easier for them to reopen their economy. And I think that is underlying a lot of this wishful reporting, is that there's a perceived need to get this over with so we can get back to work. And so you look for whatever hopeful signs you can point to that say that it's okay to go back to having economic activity, even though the virus is still out there. And in most places where they're talking about reopening, there's far more cases now than there were when the economy was shut down in the first place.
Yeah, which makes it hard to follow. But let me just ask you, I know you just wrote something about Sweden, which is another place folks were first thought was a good model, then thought, that wasn't such a good model. What's that about now?
Yes, the New York Times, again, had a story talking about the apparent success in Sweden, where they have not had a lockdown and tried to get by with social distancing and banning gatherings over 50 people, but have not told people to stay home. And a lot of people point to Sweden and say, see, look, Sweden.
They're being more sane about
it. Yeah, and they're doing a great job. And the New York Times claimed that they have been as successful as most countries in the world at controlling the virus. And it's just not true. Per capita, in terms of deaths, they have the 10th worst outbreak in the world. That's not a success. They have like roughly a third per capita more deaths than the United States. And I don't think many people would say that the United States is a role model for dealing with the coronavirus. But Sweden has done worse. When you compare it to their neighbors, who are similar countries in terms of their social structure and population density, which I think is an important factor here, Norway and Finland have had 1/6 the number of deaths per capita as Sweden. So it's not clear to me why we're not running stories about Finland's apparent success at dealing with the coronavirus rather than looking at Sweden.
Again, it's hard not to see what's pointed to as a solution being shaped so much by what people want to see as the solution and want to happen. Well, finally, you understand that people don't think we can just stay in lockdown and just wait for a vaccine, and maybe that'll be a year or maybe that'll be 2 years. But it makes it sound as though that's all we can do. What do you just think about that framing as we go forward in terms of we've exhausted our options and now we just sit and wait?
You do see a lot of coverage that assumes that the two choices are to sit in our homes and have people basically go bankrupt as they can't work, or else to force them back into the workplace and have them take the chances with the coronavirus. And the idea that you could support people through this crisis, give people the resources they need, delay obligations like rent and debt repayment and so forth, that these things can be put off while we deal with the crisis, just is not really being seriously considered as an option. The idea that the landlord must get paid seems to be a sacred cow that really can't be trifled with.
We've been speaking with Jim Noricas. He's the editor of FAIR.org. Thanks, Jim Noricas, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me back.
The CEO of Gilead Sciences says he's humbled their drug Remdesivir shows promise of working against COVID-19. That rings rather differently than mere weeks ago when the company applied for and received so-called orphan drug status for Remdesivir, granting them a 7-year monopoly under a clause meant to encourage production of drugs few were interested in making. Gilead had that status rescinded after elevated public outrage, presumably discovering this humility somewhere along the way. The behavior of drug companies in this pandemic is a reminder that while the virus may be novel, healthcare is a crisis all the time in this country, as profit-driven companies behave like profit-driven companies. In a nation where many people can't afford to both buy their medicine and pay their rent. So not allowing potential treatment for COVID-19 to be monopolized for years by Gilead is a start, but if that's where we end up, we'll still be in trouble. Here to talk about Big Pharma in the time of the coronavirus is Peter Maybarduk. He's director of Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines Program. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Peter Maybarduk.
Great to be with you.
Well, what happened with Gilead and Remdesivir and their pushing for so-called orphan status for a drug that was developed with some public spending, by the way, it just seems emblematic of the perverse incentives and system failure, regulatory system failure we have with regard to pharmaceuticals. What was set to happen there until groups like Public Citizen stepped in and shouted it down, essentially?
Gilead would have earned itself a windfall, an extra 2 years of monopoly protection over what would have been expected by gaming the system and, as you've said, claiming that a potential treatment for this world-changing pandemic was actually rare in some fashion. They put in the FDA application while there were still fewer than 200,000 cases, I believe, is the required number. That number was slated to change in a matter of days, reported cases in the United States. So they got it in just under the wire as if it were a rare disease rather than a rapidly expanding pandemic. So Gilead would have been able to exclude generic competition for longer and count on that boost and potentially higher prices and instead had to back off.
Well, you had a comment I saw saying that having to give up orphan status was a good first step for Gilead. What else do you think that they should be doing?
Well, Gilead should be focused on committing its patents and know-how to the public domain to help the world ramp up production of Remdesivir should it prove safe and effective. It's a tremendous problem that we operate under a system of monopoly drug development. It's always a problem as regards price. But in the midst of this pandemic, price is, in a sense, almost the least of our concerns. It's a concern. It's real. It's going to be a problem. But greater problems involve getting up to scale for supply so that everyone who needs treatment can get it. No corporation has manufacturing capacity sufficient to treat the world. It will be an even greater problem as regards potential vaccines. So we really need companies cooperating with other companies and with governments and allowing any qualified manufacturer to produce these treatments. Manufacturing capacity is one part. The other part is just we need all the information, all the science, all the know-how, all the technology in the public domain so that we can build on it and develop better treatments, better tools, so that someone could make a better Remdesivir or could draw on the lessons of the science for another product or combine it with another product in some fashion and keep improving the medical response. All that gets fragmented, the response limited, if companies are monopolizing these treatments and saying we're going to enforce our patent and so on.
Well, if I could build on that to get your thoughts on another place where the U.S. can seem out of touch, besides just the whole idea that healthcare and profit making don't mix, is the idea of international cooperation. How badly has U.S. isolationism or exceptionalism impacted the coronavirus response? Or to say it differently, how might such international cooperation move us forward here?
We're very concerned about the Trump administration's maneuvers to potentially pull U.S. funding from the World Health Organization, generally denigrating international cooperation. There are allegations that the Trump administration tried to purchase a German vaccine manufacturing company, have them move to the United States. The administration has put restrictions on 3M's ability to export masks to Mexico. We actually need the integrity of the supply chain preserved. We need global leadership and coordination right now because no company has sufficient capacity to tend to global need, nor does any given country. And the nature of a pandemic, and this pandemic too, which seems to come with dangers of reinfection, the disease courses through one part of the world and comes back. And so if one country fails to control the pandemic, other countries are going to pay a price. And so we all need to be working together on that. It applies not just to the United States. It's in the United States' interest that we're working with other countries to have the most robust response possible, to make sure healthcare workers are getting what they need, to make sure the disease is getting tamped down so it doesn't come back worse and harder here, let alone the economic and security consequences of the pandemic really ravaging vulnerable parts of the world, something that the United States and all countries may have to steward for a very long time to come. So nationalism is a pretty dangerous idea to be flirting with right now, and there are tremendous positive alternatives if we decide to really go in on this together. We can pool the world's science and technology to accelerate the development of better medical tools, to ensure that there is ample manufacturing capacity worldwide for personal protective equipment, for masks and ventilators, but also for medicines and vaccines, not even just those related to coronavirus per se, but medicines that are going into shortage. The cost of moving medicines around the world is increasing. Supply chains are endangered. We have to sort of redouble our efforts to make sure the supply chains are working. If we work on that together globally, we can make it happen. There's a proposal for the World Health Organization to shepherd an open technology platform where companies like Gilead and entities like U.S. government that invest quite a bit of taxpayer dollars in technology would put all their know-how and tech together so that qualified manufacturers the world over could say, I want to use that. I've got an idea for how I can build on that to make something better. Or we have manufacturing capacity in our part of the world to produce that technology there as well to make sure there's adequate supply in our part of the world. WHO can lead in that, but it may need U.S. support to do so, and we're obviously having a hard time getting there under President Trump.
Yeah, there is another vision, yet another area where there is another vision that is sometimes obscured from us, including by U.S. media. Well, let me just ask you, beyond Gilead and Remdesivir, I know that Public Citizen has issued a call to big pharmaceutical companies about not price gouging in a pandemic. And it's not just about, as you've just sort of indicated, it's not just about COVID-19 related drugs. It's about really all drugs as well.
That's right. It's standard practice for pharmaceutical companies across their portfolios to increase the price of old drugs on average of 10% per year. It's an outrageous practice when you think about it. These aren't the new drugs. These price increases aren't contributing anything to innovation, but they do contribute to treatment rationing and people's suffering. It is literally just a practice that what's become standard business in the pharmaceutical industry. You raise your prices every year. Prices don't go down over time. They go up, and the monopoly environment obviously helps facilitate that. So we think the bare minimum that the world should be expecting of the pharmaceutical industry in the midst of this pandemic is not to make the problem worse.
Well, yeah, you might say almost that any price raise is gouging. Gouging sounds like some kind of extreme term, but we're already at a moment where people are going to have less money. Some are going to have no job. So a regular, for the industry, a regular old price hike on a drug can really mean a huge difference in someone's life, yeah?
That's right. Financial hardship and emotional hardship may get worse as people's sense of isolation increases. And, of course, we're suffering historic rates of job loss in the United States right now. Many people are getting by without insurance. Now, even before the pandemic, we had a very serious problem of treatment rationing. Close to 1 in 3 people reportedly rationing their own access to medicine at some point due to its cost. Insulin rationing has resulted in a number of people's deaths in the United States. And, of course, we have a crisis of deaths of despair, of an overdose crisis in the United States. Now, we need to make sure that everyone can afford their insulin. We need to make sure that cities can afford naloxone and other overdose antidotes in ample supply, again, so everybody can access them. That is harder if prices are going up while ability to pay is going down. So it's just a minimum contribution to not price gouge during a pandemic.
Well, at the end of this write-up recently in which Gilead's CEO said that they're very humbled and it seemed like a real change of tune from just a few weeks ago, the CEO makes these statements about building a global consortium of pharmaceutical and chemical manufacturers to expand global capacity and production and countries working together and collaborative efforts. So it sounds like they're at least saying they're going to do some of the things that folks would be calling on them to do. So is that a change of tune for them, or what did we maybe miss on the original go-round on that story?
There is some recognition in the pharmaceutical industry that these are not ordinary times and that they need to strike a different tone. There are, of course, also areas where scaling up supply matches business interests. There are ways in which Gilead has been a little out ahead of some other companies in its announcements that it in its efforts in general to work with suppliers in other parts of the world. So while we were outraged by the apparent cynicism of the orphan drug exclusivity maneuver, it's not generally the case that we're trying to single out Gilead here. There is a tremendous problem with the business model and both corporate malfeasance and just too much public acceptance of a really terrible business model. What Gilead has announced here, their voluntary mechanisms are not enough to do what we really need to do as a matter of public health in the pandemic. They're not enough because it may not be enough supply. It won't liberate the science the way that we want. But also, we don't have any checks and balances. It's just Gilead telling us in still rather vague terms what it hopes to do. We have to actually be in a position to mandate what must be done, because all of our health is really at stake if we don't respond quickly enough. So we shouldn't just take like sort of commitments to sort of very, very loose ideas and Gilead saying that they're going to take care of it. We actually have to step in and insist and ensure. There could be a pretty big difference between Gilead working with a few manufacturers that it has chosen on its terms and the U.S. government saying we are going to ensure that all qualified manufacturers can make it. That could be a big difference of scale. That could be a big difference of price. That could be a big difference in access to the know-how. So we really need to insist.
We've been speaking with Peter Maybarduke, Director of Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines Program. Find their work online at citizen.org. Peter Maybarduke, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Taste of Tejano with Monica Frias-Holman and Sarah Bustamante and Tommy Andrade.
Es un gran honor, and with great respect, que le traemos un poquito de some of our favorite artists who have inspired us throughout the years para traerles nuestra música. Para todos ustedes, a taste of Tejano.